I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Terry Fallis joins me now. The author has just published his third novel, Up and Down. It is described as a humor-infused romp featuring David Stewart, who leaves his job on Parliament Hill to join the team at a PR firm in Toronto. In the book, David is assigned to a project with the Canadian Space Agency and NASA in an effort to raise public awareness about the space program. We'll get Mr. Fallis to tell us about this book, and I'll ask him about his career thus far as a novelist. Since he self-published his first book 4 years ago, The Best Laid Plans, has gone on to great renown and noteworthiness in the Canadian literary scene. It's won the Stephen Leacock Medal and went on to be published by McClelland and Stewart, and last year was the winner of the CBC Canada Reads competition. That first book, its sequel, The High Road, and this new book have been serialized as a podcast, drawing in subscribers from all over the world. Podcasts of this new book can be downloaded off of iTunes. TerryFallis.com is the website for more. Terry Fallis grew up in Toronto, earning an engineering degree at McMaster and going into Canadian politics, working for a number of cabinet ministers in Ottawa and at Queen's Park. He is the co-founder of the public relations firm Thornley Fallis. Joining me from Toronto this morning, please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Terry Fallis. Mr. Fallis, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. So this new book, David Stewart, he's the, the lead character. Was he in the previous books?
No, he is a new character, and so the narrator in the first two novels was a guy named Daniel Addison. So this is a new character and a new narrator.
Yeah, no, the PR, that's where, I guess, all the staffers of politicians and media hacks, that's where they end up when they leave their jobs. That's what you did, I guess, right?
In a way, it is. Yeah. Yes, I did. I worked on Parliament Hill for a few years, then I worked at Queen's Park in the Ontario government here in Toronto for a few years, and then I, in the early part of January 1988, I joined a multinational PR agency called Hill & Knowlton. So it is not an uncommon career path for former politicos and journalists.
Yeah, and so Stewart leaves a job on the Hill, joins a PR firm in Toronto, and space, I guess, is his project, right?
Right. Yeah, that's right. And it isn't autobiographical, but I am definitely a member in good standing of the Write What You Know school of writing.
Right.
So I'm clearly borrowing heavily from my experiences working at a multinational PR agency. But I have had a long-standing interest in space that I can trace back to the summer of 1969 when I was 9 years old and a camper at Camp White Bear in a remote island in the southwest arm of Lake Temagami, 60 miles north of North Bay, Ontario. And on July 20th, 1969, the entire camp gathered in the main lodge for a campfire, and when everyone else had almost fallen asleep, it was about almost 11 o'clock, a TV was produced, and thanks to rabbit ears and a couple of rolls of tinfoil, we somehow managed to bring in a signal, and when the snowy screen sort of revealed the image, it was of Neil Armstrong standing on what they literally call the porch of the lunar module in the on the surface of the moon, and something clicked inside me back then, and I have been fascinated by space ever since. So I thought I would combine my profession of public relations and my knowledge of it with a passion that I've always had about space, and write a novel that brings those two together, and that's what Up and Down is.
When Armstrong died several weeks ago, we were reminded about how important space was in the consciousness of North Americans and people around the world. Reminded about how what a big deal it was. I mean, that day in 69 for you, and in subsequent years or after, but it's sort of space and the interest in it has gone down. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think back then, the first Yuri Gagarin, the first Russian cosmonaut, the first human in space, happened in, I believe it was 1961. So by the time 1969 rolled around, when Neil Armstrong was there, there had only been a handful of people in space. And starting with the shuttle program in the very early 80s, there have been literally, I think, a couple of hundred shuttle launches and missions, and we have not really gone beyond Earth orbit since then, focusing on building the International Space Station. And I think we have just become inured to the excitement and the incredible achievement of space travel. We've seen so many shuttle launches and landings, they've just become routine, and we've become blasé about it. And as a consequence, I think we've seen as our interest has declined, I think we've seen a commensurate decline in the funding from Congress. So I think we've just become bored with it. There was a flash of excitement when the Mars Curiosity lander landed successfully on the surface of Mars. That moment brought back memories of the great space achievements of an earlier era, and I hope we have more of those in our future.
We also hear from people that don't like the space program because they say, well, why are we going to Mars? Why are we going outside of the world when there's so much poverty?
Right.
There's so much, so many other problems on this planet. But, you know, the success you've had with these books, for example, podcasting, the internet, computers, wouldn't have happened were it not for the space program, right?
No, that's exactly right, and I certainly understand the views of those who say that we could spend this money that we spend on space in a way that helps more people on Earth, and that is undoubtedly true. But I think the intangible is what the public interest in space has done for sort of the morale, for the it inspires people. The inspiration it has brought to people to achieve and to reach beyond what they thought might have been possible in the past. So I think there's an intangible effect of the space program that is hard to quantify but is no less real. Not to mention, of course, the technology and the industries that and the research and development that has been fueled by the space program have brought considerable economic benefits to society in both countries, Canada, the United States, well, in other countries too, Russia and China and Japan, of course. So I think there are wonderful spin-off benefits, but I am not deaf to the arguments of those who think that we could be spending that money elsewhere. That may be true, but I think the benefits outweigh the risks.
So Stewart, David Stewart, the character in the book, is at this PR firm, and he's approached, I guess the firm's approached by NASA and the Canadian Space Program to sort of do publicity work for their projects, is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
To rekindle public interest in space so that Congress doesn't shut down the funding.
Yeah. It made me think of our space program here in this country. We seem to forget that there is one. We know of Mark Garneau, we know of Roberta Bondar, but how is our own program in Canada doing?
Well, I think it's doing well. I think we could use some more funding. Back in the early 80s, when the Canadian astronaut program began, and they brought in their first, I think we had six originally, five of whom actually flew missions. Then a second cohort was introduced several years later, and they are still flying. In fact, Chris Hadfield is about, well, I guess in December, he is in training now, but in December he'll be launching from Star City in Russia to go to the International Space Station, where he will be commander, the first Canadian commander of the space station, for a six-month stint. And I hope that will renew some focus on the Canadian angle of that, the space station program. And Mark Garneau, who is now a Liberal MP and former president, or CEO, I guess, of the Canadian Space Agency, has recently talked about what he thinks we ought to be focused on in the future in space, Canada's future in space. And he has called for a all-Canadian robotic mission to Mars. So the Mars Curiosity lander that the U.S. has put there, with some Canadian content, of course, he thinks we ought to develop our own Mars lander, and that we have the technology to do that. We would need a launch vehicle to get it there, but we have a long history in space. Canada was only the third nation to design and build a satellite that operated successfully. It was the Alouette. We're about to celebrate the 50th anniversary later this month of the launch of the Alouette satellite. And we don't think of Canada as a huge player in space, yet we were the third industrialized nation, the third nation, to have an object in orbit that worked as well as the Alouette did. So we have a track record and a history and a legacy, and I know people like Mark Garneau, and certainly I would love to see that to continue.
And do you think there's the political will to do so with this current government?
I hope so. I don't know that. I mean, Mark Garneau's vision is that the budget of the Canadian Space Agency would be doubled in the coming years, not all at once, but over the next several years, to fund such a mission to Mars and the other work that the space agency does. I don't know that that's realistic. I hope it is, and I would encourage the government to go down that path. But you know, we're still in a bit of an economic malaise right now, and we have a deficit that we're trying to tackle as well. So it's a difficult time to be seeking public funding for space science. Though I think it is a very good investment and would pay off in the long run.
Another character in the book is named Landon Percival. She's quite a popular character online with some readers of the book, as I've read on the internet. I'm interested to know, how did these characters, David Stewart and Landon Percival, how did they get their names?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not very good at coming up with names, so I often will look to people I know or to family history to pick out names. And David Stewart is actually the first name and the middle name of a younger brother I had, who died in a car accident many, many, many years ago. So in a way, it's kind of a small tribute to him. And the Percival name in Landon Percival's name is the middle name of my grandfather. So there are some family connections in the creation of the names, as I sort of pay tribute to them, my younger brother and my grandfather.
And to whom you dedicate this book, right?
Yes, they are both, they are the two to whom the book is dedicated, that's right.
Yeah, now I also read somewhere that you have a twin.
I do. I have an identical twin brother named Tim, yeah. And we are very, very much alike. I assure you it is Terry who was doing the interview, but I'm sure that Tim could probably pull it off, and only people who really know us well might notice the difference. Our mannerisms are very, very similar. Voices are similar. We have similar interests, and we're very close. I see him all the time.
Yeah. Now, what does he do for a living?
He has his own promotions and marketing agency called BlackRock Marketing Group here in Toronto, and does very well. So we are in a similar line of work, though not quite in the same spot in the marketing communications PR spectrum.
Yeah. Did you always want to write growing up?
Well, it has been a dream for a very long time. I wrote a handful of short stories, and when I say a handful, I think like literally four or five over the course of about 15 years or so that I never sent anywhere. It was just recreational. But I've always had this idea of writing a novel, a comic novel, a funny novel, because those are the books I love to read, and I think it's good advice to writers to try and write something that you would like to read, because I think it's easier for you to judge it in that way. So I finally, after having the idea of writing a novel on my New Year's resolution list for about 5 or 6 years running, I finally decided to take a stab at it. I didn't know whether I could. It was an experiment. It was a personal challenge to see whether I could string 100,000 words together in a way that somehow approached coherence. And when I finished it, I honestly didn't know whether I had written a novel. When you labor over something and are immersed in it for so long, your sense of perspective on it easily abandons you. And so I didn't know whether the story held together, whether the characters were believable, or whether the whether it was funny. I just had this faint sense that it was finished. So it's been a tremendous shock and a joy that the first novel, which led to the second, which led to the third, that it's all gone so well. I feel like I've exhausted my lifetime allocation of good fortune.
You the success of the first book, I mean, they've written about that elsewhere. It wasn't really luck. It was just perseverance on your part, publishing it yourself, getting
right.
that out. Do you think the way that came about with the first book, it really is indicative of our times and the sort of publishing business where it's at today, right?
It is, and it's still in a great state of flux, and I was just trying things back then to see whether I could get some traction somewhere. I was interested in building an audience for this novel I had written after being rather spectacularly unsuccessful in attracting any interest or attention from the traditional publishing world. So I, in a grand experiment of social media, this emerging world of social media, I decided to podcast the novel in its entirety, chapter by chapter, and it really just as a way of getting it out there, to see whether or not people liked it, to see whether I had in fact written a novel or just written a lot of words. Truman Capote said, that's not writing, that's typing.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure what I was doing was writing and not typing. And the reaction to the podcast, I consider to be the first impartial, unbiased feedback I ever had to the manuscript, and it was that very positive and gratifying feedback that gave me the resolve to go ahead and self-publish it. So, yeah, there are many more options writers have at their disposal now to get their work out there. Having said that, I am thrilled and honored to be published by McClellan and Stewart, because it does make things easier and it helps me reach a broader audience. But I guess none of it would have happened had I not started that podcast back in the January of 2007.
And the podcasting of the books, that does the listeners and downloads, that translates to book sales, does it?
Well, it's hard to say with certainty, but I truly believe that it does, and I think the anecdotal evidence bears that out. So the premise is that if people listen to the novel in one format, in this case the audio version, and enjoy it for free, they will, at least many of them, or some of them at least, will want to own a copy of the novel and they will buy it. So I truly believe that the reach of the internet and of the podcast brought the novel to many more ears than would ever have seen it had I just self-published it. And I truly believe that we have sold more books and created a larger audience for my writing by giving away the audio version of it for free. And McClellan and Stewart agreed with that notion, because even when I signed with them for my second and third novels, they allowed me to podcast the novel as I did for my first one, and give it away for free. So I think they have come a long way, and I applaud their enlightened thinking in allowing me to do that. But in the end, I think we're selling more books because the podcast is available and for free.
What's it like to work with Doug Gibson?
It's an extraordinary thrill and a pleasure. I mean, Doug Gibson is my editor and my publisher at McClellan & Stewart. He has his own imprint there. He is an icon in the publishing, in Canadian publishing history. He was Robertson Davies' editor, W.O. Mitchell's editor, Mavis Gallant's editor, Hugh McLennan. He's edited the last three prime ministerial memoirs. He is and always will be Alice Munro's editor, so I don't really know why he's my editor, but I am honored and thrilled that he is, and he's a wonderful guy. He has a great book of his own out now called Stories About Storytellers, and he does a wonderful stage production of it in a way, a one-man show, and it's just to take a stroll through the history of Canadian publishing with Doug Gibson is a wonderful way to spend some time if you ever get a chance to see it or read the book. So he's very gentle in his editing. I think the harshest I ever saw in my, as I went through the manuscript of mine that he had edited, he drew a line down beside two paragraphs, and he wrote in little pencil script that he uses that said, "You're taxing the reader's attention here." That's about as harsh as he gets. And before I'd even finished reading his comment, I had slashed out those two paragraphs. So I trust his judgment implicitly, and it really is an honor. And he's such a nice guy, and he's become a good friend. So it's a thrill. I mean, if he ever said, "I think you should cut out chapters 1 through 9 in this manuscript," I would do it in an instant.
Yeah. Are you working on another book?
I am, and I'm in what I sort of call the noodling stage. I am mapping out in my mind still a fourth novel, but I have got lots of notes on it, and it's coming together. It's not quite ready for me to draft my detailed outline. I am an inveterate outliner. I think I write like an engineer. That's my process. I need a blueprint for my novel before I can actually write the manuscript. So I have a very detailed chapter-by-chapter outline before I write the first word of the manuscript, and that's the process I've used for all three of the novels, and I'm using in the fourth, and it seems to work for me, and it allows me, when I come to write the manuscript, to focus all of my attention and questionable cerebral powers on crafting the words themselves, rather than devoting a portion of my brain to figuring out what's going to happen next. I like to have all of that thinking done first before I actually write, and not many, I don't think, writers take that approach, but it works for me, and I'm very comfortable with it.
I'm enjoying the book, Terry, and it's been great talking today. Congratulations on the book, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. The book is called Up and Down. It's a Douglas Gibson book published by McClelland & Stewart. Its author, Terry Fallis, on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.